is Matt Segundo here, and I empathize with our guest's surname. You see, because my last name is Segundo, when I sit in a restaurant with another person, a very rare occasion, the waiter always hands me the menu second. When I stand in line at my bank and try to clear a check, and there is nobody else in front of me, the tellers ask another teller to stand in front of me so that I am always second. I am not sure if David Peace suffered these terrible indignities related to his name, but if he does, I would urge him to go to war.
Hi, we're here with David Peace, the author of The Red Riding Quartet, GB84 The Damned United, and most recently, Tokyo Year Zero. Glad to have you aboard, David.
Thank you very much.
So my first question kind of has to do with locale, because your previous work had all been set in the UK, but you've lived abroad in Japan since 1994, and this is the first book that you've chosen to set in Japan. Now, instead of sort of asking the usual, why did you set this in Japan, what I'm more curious about is, why did it take you so long to set a book in Japan?
Well, that's a good question. I had this book, this plan to write about Tokyo was from a moment, really quite early on once I got there, I kind of felt that I wanted to write about the place, but I just didn't have, basically, the short answer is I just didn't have the confidence. I thought, you know, I wrote all the other books, the first six books I wrote in Tokyo, but they were all set in, obviously, a time and place in which I'd grown up. Not being able to read Japanese kanji meant that I was worried that I wouldn't be able to, I would miss some research, or, you know, I was really, and also just worried about, you know, there's so much that's written about Japan just seems to be cliched or not true, or, and I just didn't want to contribute to it by error.
Cliched in what way?
Well, you know, there are stereotypes of Japanese people, you know, people make pronouncements and things that, you know, and I just don't think you can, you know, I mean, the difficult thing about talking about Japanese people is that actually Japanese people, I'm contradicting myself as I'm saying it, but Japanese people actually generalize about themselves. So they see themselves as a unified, unique people, some of them. And then actually that also, you know, people, you know, outside of Japan, then pick up on that and say, you know, they talk about the Japanese, but, you know, it's, I think it's 120 million people. I mean, you know, they're not all the same. So, I mean, and I, so anyway, to cut a long story short, gradually, I wrote two, the first four books were published in Japan, in Japanese, by Hayakawa, who are their kind of leading crime fiction publisher. And 1974, the first Red Riding Quartet in Japanese was actually like a minor kind of bestseller. But they didn't really want, Hayakawa didn't really want GB84, and they certainly didn't want The Damned United. So another publisher, who are actually more similar to Faber in the UK, but they, for example, do publish Elroy in Japan. A young editor there called Mr. Nagashima bought GB84, and we went out for dinner to celebrate him buying it. And he was aware that I had a plan to write some books about Tokyo, but I said that, you know, I didn't have the confidence. And he then said, well, you know, why not? And we started talking. I said, well, I was worried about missing out on the research, and he very kindly said he would help with the research. And so, for example, I would go to Bungei Shunju have a what they call the morgue, which is where they keep all the dead newspapers.
Oh, sure,
from the
yeah,
past,
like here. Yeah.
And we would, you know, when we decided what we were gonna, when I, you know, I would say to him, August 1946, I want to go through the papers, and he would just read off headlines to me, which I couldn't read in the kanji. And if the story was interesting, I would say, you know, okay, let's tell me more about it, and I would be taking notes. I mean, I think he must be. He must feel he was wasting his time, because very little of it actually ended up in the book. But it was good for me to know that I wasn't missing something. And just sorry to backtrack, what I meant, why the reason I brought up Hayakawa was because in order to promote the Red Riding Quartet, I did write two short stories that were set in Japan based on real crimes, and they were published in the Hayakawa Mystery Magazine.
Oh, okay.
And when I was writing these two stories again, it helped me to gain the confidence. But I mean, it's been, originally it was going to be the Showa Quartet, and it was originally going to go from 1946 to the Tokyo Olympics. I mean, it shrunk to being the Tokyo Trilogy. Yeah, sorry, I'm rabbiting again.
I think actually you managed to touch on about six different questions that I was going to do. But no, that's totally fine. What I'll narrow it to this, which is, when did this conversation take place in relation to when an excerpt or a portion of it appeared in Granta during the whole Young British Novelist?
Well, no, the Granta extract was from GB84.
Oh, well,
there's two. No, there's two extracts. Granta did the GB84 extract, and then at the end of last year, they did an extract from Tokyo Year Zero.
Okay.
That's what, yeah. But that, the conversation with Nagashima must have taken place in 2005.
Okay.
2005.
You had mentioned that originally this was supposed to be the Showa Quartet that would run from the 40s through the Tokyo Olympics.
Yes.
So what made you decide to sort of shrink it down? Well, because obviously Elroy had his quartet, George Pelicanos has had his quartet.
Yeah, yeah. I already had a quartet, so with a Red Riding Quartet. But the Showa Quartet was always going to begin with this Kodaira case. So the first book never really changed. But the more I read about the occupation period, the 45 to 52 years, during that period there were these three crimes which are the basis for the trilogy. And really after that, there wasn't really anything I felt that allowed, you know, possibly to you know, I mean, I choose the crimes for as much as what they say about the time and the place and the society in which they happened than for the crimes themselves. And really, after that, there was nothing, you know, there were sensational crimes, but to me, I couldn't see the wider significance of them. So it really then just became a trilogy about the occupation of Japan, or really, the occupation of Tokyo. Yeah.
I mean, you've hit on it exactly. I mean, the crime that is talked about in Tokyo Year Zero, it's certainly ever-present, and it's shocking, and it is full of pain, but it really is more of a jumping-off point for everything else you have to say.
Yeah, I mean, that is the intention. I think at the same time, the book is, I mean, the crimes are quite explicit and quite violent. I am, you know, have become aware that, you know, obviously this is, I mean, you know, in a good way, but people are not, like, immune to this and to the way that I've written about them. And so, but, you know, but I'm not doing it in a kind of Thomas Harris, you know, kind of voyeuristic kind of way. I'm trying. The books are written. I have no interest in serial killers. I mean, the books are, what I have is an interest in why these victims become victims, and the effect that the crimes have on the journalists and the policemen, and the society. Not even the killer is kind of.
He shows up pretty early. We know who he is. It's dispensed of.
Yeah. Well, they're not really the reason. I don't write the books to kind of gain insight into the mind of a serial killer. It's to the society in which they occurred. You
know. No. If anything, the sense of pain is countrywide, and just the language that you use. Things like having either Manami or other characters as a whole say, you know, we are the survivors, we are the lucky ones, and yet here's all this tumult and horrendous imagery.
I wanted to really just, I mean, you know, just, you know, in Britain and in the States, I mean, of course we've been defeated in foreign wars, but we've not been defeated on our own soil. We've not surrendered, we've not occupied, and I really wanted to know, you know, what it must have been like for ordinary Japanese people in that year and at that time, and, you know, particularly then what it would be like for the police faced with an investigation and while they themselves are being investigated. And this was the reason I wrote the book, really.
I mean, if anything, setting this book in Japan in 1946 is, and this may seem a bit out of left field, as close as you're going to get to describing what a living zombie might be like.
Yeah. Yeah, but I mean, and particularly in the second book, again, I would think the second novel is more, the second of a trilogy is more, I mean, it's probably closer to a horror novel than it is to a crime novel. I mean, you know, yeah.
Well, that's interesting you bring it up, because in light of the Japanese crime fiction that's been translated here, so much of it really does border on horror.
Well, yeah, I mean, particularly, thinking of like Kirino and Out, and Grotesque. I mean, there is that, I think there's a kind of a certain gothic quality, if you like, to much Japanese crime fiction.
Yeah, I mean, one thing that strikes me both about this work and sort of Japanese crime fiction as a whole is this element of kind of dissociation or dichotomy, in that, as you've sort of said at the beginning, Japanese people and certainly Western attitudes are of sort of a unified whole. There's this stereotype of, I guess, submissiveness, and that comes through in the book as well. And yet the crimes, as described in both the fiction and also in real life, sometimes they just go way beyond what you ever expect to see on Western soil. I'm thinking of the 14-year-old boy who had decapitated the little girl.
Yeah.
And Issei Sagawa became a celebrity, which...
Yeah. No, I mean, there's... I mean, you know, Japan is a, you know... is a safer country than the UK. And, you know, it's... you know, when my son goes to play in the park, I mean, touch wood, I don't really worry about him. But at the same time, there is that... You know, I mean, when the crimes that are committed do appear to be quite sensational, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, is it just because that's what's being reported and...
Well, I think, I mean, obviously they gain a lot of attention because of the sensational nature. I mean, there are kind of routine, kind of, if you like, for want of a... It's a horrible phrase, right? More routine or more ordinary killings. But, I mean, generally, you see, it's a safe, you know, it it certainly seems to lack the random violence that you would find in the UK and possibly here.
Oh, certainly here.
Yeah.
But we'll get sort of back to that that topic in a second. But one thing I really wanted to talk especially about, and I brought this up in the review of the book that I wrote for the Los Angeles Times, is this common theme you have both in this book and in previous books of repetition, be it repetition of themes, repetition of certain phrases. And so I guess my first question is more basic, which is, why is repetition important to you?
Basically works to me on two levels. You know, every day we do actually the same things and we say the same things, and there is actually very little variation. You know, I mean, obviously for me now I'm on like a book tour, so it's quite unusual. But you know, every day really when I'm writing, it's the same kind of day. And I think, you know, in our normal lives, people lead quite repetitious lives. And yet I've always felt that, you know, fiction never, or it never kind of seems to pick up on this. And so, you know, I want the books actually to be realistic. And so the repetition is, you know, I it's one of the reasons why I like the recent film Zodiac. One of the reasons I like that film is because, you know, it got slated in Japan because people said it was boring. Right, but actually, it's police investigations. This, in my experience, this is what they're like. They're not, you know, the Yorkshire Ripper inquiry lasted for, you know, 6 years, and it was just constantly repetitious. The police work, the journalism, and also then what happens is you see the killings also have a certain repetitious quality to them, unfortunately, because the police can't stop the killings, so they become a kind of repetition too. And I think, you know, we do these things in our everyday life repeatedly. And actually, you know, some of these things probably we shouldn't repeat. And we do, you know, I mean, speaking from personal experience, you know, every day, you know, I do things that I'm happy about, but I also do things I wish I hadn't done. Yeah, I know I'll make the same mistakes again and again. You know, you tell lies to some people and you don't tell lies to other people. I mean, it's just this kind of... We don't. I just feel as well. I won't talk about people in general. I just feel personally that I do. I should try to break the cycle of repetition, but I'm not very good at it. I meant stylistically. I wanted to try to reflect this, and also the repetition adds the other thing. The repetition I feel does, but obviously, certain people disagree. Is I feel it adds to the rhythm and the poetry of the work, which to me is. I think within this repetition and within what is often a kind of horror, there is a certain, you have to admit, there is a certain, it becomes a certain poetry within this. And I also want, the thing I most want is that people read the book. Well, I mean, basically, people should either read them very, very quickly or not bother, really. I do feel sorry because obviously some people just can't, you know, obviously style is not what they want to read. And so, you know, I can think of nothing worse than having, you know, being forced to read one of my books. It must be horrible. But, for people who seem to understand what I'm trying to do, obviously they tend to read them very, very quickly, and that's the manner in which they're meant to be read. And I actually feel that the repetition contributes to the pace of the book, but it's a fine line. I realise, it's a fine line. And actually, to some extent, Tokyo Year Zero is the end of that line to some extent.
In what way?
You know, and I think that really, well, Tokyo Year Zero was the first time that actually the book in my head looked like the book that came out, which might sound odd, but I have a kind of vision of what the book will be like. But unfortunately, often the book that appears is not like that. And it might have certain other qualities, but it's not really the book that you meant it to be. And Tokyo Year Zero actually was... is very similar to the book that was in my head, and that was a strange experience, because usually I've kind of written the next book against the book that's just been.
Sure.
So like The Damned United was like a kind of reaction to GB84, and so the minute I finished Tokyo Year Zero, I began the second one, Tokyo Occupied City, but it was just, you know, and I got like, I did about 80,000-90,000 words of the thing. And it was just, you know, it was just like, I just realised I'd taken that particular style of writing I'd done in Tokyo Year Zero as far as it would go, because I was just now repeating myself, which, I mean, many people would say, well, that's all you've ever done. But, I mean, really, with Year Zero, I felt I'd distilled and honed it to be what I wanted it to be. But with Occupy, in the abandoned version of Tokyo Occupied City, it'd become almost like pastiche or parody. Mm-hmm. So that all went in the bin, and now I'm going to start again.
So it's almost like, to kind of take this metaphor a little too far, but it's like you came up with that resonant rhythm, and now that you had it, you didn't need to go any further with it.
Yeah, I mean, in a way it's exciting, because I have to kind of now, you know, basically my ambition for the trilogy is that you have three books in contrasting styles, but are a trilogy. And it's not going to be, whereas I think with the Red Riding Quartet, the style kind of develops through the four books. I think, unfortunately, Year Zero starts at the kind of, you know, it's... it starts at the end point, really. It's just, I think I've gone as far as I can go with that, with what I was trying to do, with a lot of a repetition and a lot of the kind of one line. So Occupied City will be a different kind of book, really.
Now, what you were saying about the book in your head matching the book on the page, I mean, one thing I noted both in the review and just looking back through the book is that there's a real visual sense in terms of how the sentences stack up.
Yeah.
That I don't think I've really seen in much fiction, or certainly not consciously.
Well, you mean in terms of a layout of the pages?
Yeah, I mean, one thing that I noticed was in that section in the riots, and I think it's a little less than halfway through the book, with the bangs, and it's like you have this long sentence, and then you have one that's slightly... Yeah. So it's almost like a reverse cascade.
Well, no, and I've driven the editors in America and London absolutely mad, because the lines can't run over. I mean, the lines just simply can't run over, because, and I think they just think I'm mad. But if I want people to be able to read this book quickly, and so, you know, I think what people, you know, your eye is going along the line, right, and then it needs to start again. And if you go back for a little bit and then down for a little, like what we call in publishing a widow.
Yes.
You know, if you've got widows, it's delaying the speed with which people can read. And, you know, I mean, I just have a horror of widows. But as I say, that now is not, you know, now I've done that.
Sure. But do you know Mark Danielewski's work, like House of Leaves?
Yes.
So
yeah.
There was a story that for House of Leaves, he had such a vision of what the book looked like that he actually went into... his U.S. publisher's offices and did the typeface and design all from
right.
scratch.
Yeah.
Was this something you've been contemplating?
Well, if I could, yeah. I mean, really, the ideal thing would be to publish the things yourself. I mean, it's like, you know, because you've been, you know, because, I mean, you know, I when I send the manuscripts out, they've got covers and everything, and it's never, apart from The Damned United, it's never the cover I would have chosen, you know. So I actually, you know, that was a cover they actually accepted the design. You know, I'm happy with, and obviously I got approval of the covers, and I'm happy with the covers. But you know, it's yeah. I mean, I will say though that the editors have been really, really patient and diligent, because it is it does drive them nuts. And particularly, you see, when you have to take a hardback and then shrink it to a paperback, it becomes quite difficult for them. Yeah,
that's true, especially in the UK with the larger format and the mass market and the like. So just to kind of keep on the theme of repetition in that, I mean, one of the reasons I kept kind of harping on rhythm when I was reviewing it is because I have a musical background, so it's almost as if the rhythm of the book really matched certain almost like ancient songs that I knew. And it's not that I'm saying that you had them in mind, it's just that there's almost this resonance with like biblical psalms and Japanese works.
Yeah, well, I mean, that's very kind of you to say that, because that's the effect. You know, I mean, how I check the work is to read it aloud.
Sure.
So I, you know, when I've done a paragraph, I then read it aloud and, you know, just check that it kind of, and it is, you know, I mean, I'm doing this reading this evening, and it is quite, you know, I think if you hear it read, many people have said that it has that kind of like incantation kind of, which is good. I mean, that's what it's meant. If it's working, that's what it should reach to. Yeah.
Especially with the contrasting typeface, where it's regular words
and
then the italics.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, that's one of the things that, I mean, that's, to be honest, the hardest thing to leave behind for Occupied City, really, is the italics, really.
Is there any way to sort of incorporate it? Oh, you're just going to leave it wholesale?
Well, I'm not sure. I just think it's... I'll have to see. It's, but I think it's... I mean, not because of anything anyone else has said. It's just I feel, you know, I abandon these 80-odd thousand words because I just feel I'd almost become able to predict what I was going to write, which might sound strange. You might think, well, of course you must know what you're going to write. But actually, when I write... it is as if I don't know where it really comes from, but for the first time of Occupying City, I kind of wasn't really surprising myself with the work, so it become a bit kind of formulaic.
So it's taking the repetition, and then it becomes wholesale, and that's when it doesn't become fun anymore.
Yeah, yeah, and it's not. Well, it, I mean, it was never really. Well, I have to say, it was never really fun. But I.
No, I know that's not necessarily
you know,
what you're
talking about. But you know, but it was just become. Just felt more like it felt too much like a job.
So sort of to keep on rhythm and music, I had read somewhere that when you wrote GB84, that it was almost entirely to a Shostakovich soundtrack. Was there any sort of soundtrack that informed writing Tokyo Year Zero and then Occupied City?
Yeah, I mean, I've listed some of the bands in the back of the book. Yeah, I mean, I mean, usually what I do is to use music from a time and a place to help kind of like bring back memories. But obviously, I have no memories of Tokyo 1946. I did track down songs and things, particularly the Apple song, which recurs through, which was the big hit of that year, and that was an important thing in the book, because the Apple song to many Japanese represented hope, but in the book it becomes less hope. It doesn't represent hope to Minami. But I was really listening to kind of like hardcore Japanese, kind of not the noise stuff so much as the kind of like some kind of more like I was called kabuki metal, but it's some kind of strange kind of stuff that I've come across. Yeah,
and it just got you in that mindset of going back.
Yeah.
Oh, very interesting.
That's what you, as I'm actually doing the writing, I'm doing that. But then obviously, you know, in order to check it, as I say, I have to have silence to read it aloud myself. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Now, something else that comes through as related to the imagery is just that this book really evokes certain senses, be it the stench of death. I mean, one common phrase that comes up is rotten apricots, rotten fruit.
Yeah.
So did you really feel consciously of evoking not just, say, vocal senses, but also smell and touch?
Yeah, I mean, that was, and sound. I mean, so there's a lot of, like, in the book, there are like sounds like Gary Gary and Chikutaku, and the sounds. So it was a kind of, I wanted a sonic landscape, if you like, and also then the smells, just to make it kind of more multidimensional, because I mean, to try to kind of give a sense of what that time and place were like.
Yeah, I mean, especially with the tong-tong, the hammering.
Yeah, well, the hammering, yeah, because I mean, the hammering the hammering came from a Dazai story, which is called The Sound of Hammering, and it's set during like the Reconstruction years, and obviously the hammering and yellow wood was symbols of hope for many Japanese, but for Minami it becomes a kind of a horrible kind of metronome ticking, depressing kind of metronome, bang, tong, tong,
which sort
tong,
of comes
tong.
Back to the whole rhythm and musical applications.
So
I guess it's almost like, in light of reaction so far, it's like, if people don't get the rhythm of the book, they're not going to get the book, and if sort of they're off rhythm, they might not.
No, but I mean, it's as I said to you before, I don't. It's a dangerous thing to read reviews, I'd rather to be honest, given the kind of work I write, I think I've always been very fortunate, to be honest. And that people like yourself have been very, very supportive. And I would rather be... I mean, I don't think people are indifferent to the work. They either support it or they don't. And that's I think, the best way.
Now, just to go off a little bit, there's one, I guess, point that comes up in your work that... I'm very interested about, and that's sort of how women are treated, because either they're sort of idealized, and I'm thinking of, in Tokyo Year Zero, you have Yuki, who is sort of the woman that Manami holds in high esteem, and there's a real hallucinatory quality about her, but there are also women who are savagely murdered, there are prostitutes who run, there's Manami's wife, who is, kind of the epitome of submission. So, is it in this case, is it just the time period that perhaps didn't allow for more shaded a portrayal?
Well, to me, women, for women in the books, in all the books, are the victims, unfortunately, in my experience, in the cases that I've written, in the times and places I've written about, women and children to some degree have been the victims, and that the men that I've written about have tended to see women in this kind of black and white kind of way. There's lines in the book like the men are the women and the women are the men. The things that women, say, just talking about specifically about Tokyo Year Zero, the things that women had to do in order to survive, but the things that women have to do in order to survive now as well. I mean, I just think, as I say, I mean, puts them often in the position of being victims. And this goes back to what I was saying before about the repetitious quality of our existence. Minami in the book seems incapable of seeing people in any other way than the idealized Yuki, or the victims, who are. I think the relationship with his wife is quite complex, actually.
I think what struck me is that I would have liked to know more about where she was coming from, and that, she was staying home with the kids and he was away much of the time because of his work. But I guess I felt like I had some insight into what she had to do to survive, but not quite a good handle on her perspective on the relationship.
The problem is... but the book is told simply through his perspective. So again, it's kind of like, I felt it was a bit, This has come up before in editorial discussions about the work, but I just felt it's a bit 2007 to project this onto a character in Tokyo in 1940. See, I mean, Japan even now is a very, very hierarchical, masculine society. I mean, I worry greatly about my daughter growing up in such a, you know, even when you go out with like, you know, it's when I have to choose my words carefully. When, you know, men and women from the same company can go out together and they're of equal position, but the women are supposed to pour the beer for the men and to keep their glasses refilled, even though you'd be holding the same job. I mean, I just think this is like, you know, what the fuck is this? You know, it's 2007. But, so I think it's, you know, not... as I say, I think it would have been a bit of a kind of cop-out to have kind of then suddenly kind of offered insights into characters which Minami simply wouldn't have had.
Sure.
Yeah.
I guess what I'm thinking too is that...
But I know what you mean. Yeah.
Where would it be appropriate, considering that you're setting the books in 1940s and 50s Japan, to have, say, a woman who isn't either a victim or... You know, just or an idealized.
Yeah,
but
I mean, I can't. This is the problem. I mean, you know, in Occupied City, you know, I'm not sure how many women there will be in Occupied. I mean, you know, and in the Damned United, I think there were hardly any women at all. So
but it was,
I mean,
about football.
Yeah, but I mean, it's. But even then, people said, "Well, there were no women." But there were no women in football in the 1970s. I mean, it's not. But again, it was came back. We had the same thing. More insight into. The wife and things.
Could it be said that you're attracted to subject matters that lend themselves more to dominantly masculine takes?
I mean, I mean, you know, this isn't a cop-out, but I was raised in West Yorkshire, which is not the most liberal place to be raised. And then I live in Japan, which, again, is not the most liberal place. You know, and I've chosen to write about places where I don't think that, you know, if I was a woman, I would be moving out of these places, yeah? But that does not mean I am, like, you know, a sexist or a misogynist or...
No, I wasn't implying that.
I know you were, but I just... for the record.
No, I guess I'm just fascinated by, you know, why do writers choose the subjects that they choose, whether it's conscious or not?
Yeah, well, I don't... This is the... You know, I mean, the terrible thing about... book tours is that you like, I'm not really big on self-analysis, you know, I write the books and, you know, to some extent I don't know where they come from or I don't want to know where they come from. And then when you go like this is like a 3-week tour of just talking about yourself incessantly and, you know, it's, you know, I mean, some writers end book tours like with nervous breakdowns and it's because they've been kind of forced to really confront things that possibly they wouldn't. Want
or if
confront.
They confront it, it's on the page and they want to let it speak
and
to it.
You just, it's I can see why Cormac McCarthy never did an interview until Oprah Winfrey. And he shouldn't have done that either.
Yeah, that wasn't exactly his finest ever. It's true. Sort of related to that, and I know you likely get asked this a lot, but you know, you've spoken a lot about how your way of approaching fiction is to meld fact and fiction to get at emotional truths. So, I mean, was this always your intention, or have you ever thought of just creating an entire world of your own imagination?
Well, I did. I mean, I wrote a book. When I was 18 to 25, I was writing this huge, you know, which must have been well over like 500,000 word book. Which I then sent out on my, you know, I then sent out on my 25th birthday to every publisher in the UK, and every publisher in the UK wrote back, and you know, in no uncertain terms, let me know that they didn't want the book, and that was really a book that was kind of largely made up, and even the reason I don't like 1974 very much is because again, it was really I mean the crimes were actually Japanese crimes actually that I then took and transposed to Yorkshire. But it wasn't really, you know, while I was, it was really 1977, and then writing about the Yorkshire Ripper, but then really, you know, I just thought, I mean, I don't have a very good imagination anyway, so I mean, it was, I just thought, why would you make things up? I mean, everyday stuff happens that, you know, it's just just, you know, there's enough we don't understand who we are and why we are without making up other stuff. That's not to say, though, that, you know, I don't think other people should, you know, I mean, I read a lot of, for pleasure, read a lot of science fiction, for example, and horror, and, you know. So, I mean, I'm all for fantasy worlds, but just I'm not capable of making them up, that's all.
Well, it's interesting to bring that up also, because certainly in America, all the talk has been about memoirs and fiction and truth, and now we have James Frey.
Well, yeah, and I actually, to be honest, I think it's, as you're aware, it's increasingly harder to publish fiction, because people don't, you know, there seems to be this desire to read more like memoirs and non-fiction. And I think in a way if I've survived as long as I have, it's because actually by writing novels about things that actually happened, I kind of slightly feed off that, you know, the interest in the non-fiction. And I think it makes it easier for the publisher because, you know, I'm writing books that, you know, not to be unkind to other authors, but my books are actually about something. So it's, you know, about a thing that happened. So, yeah.
So what keeps you on the novel side as opposed to purely non-fiction, especially with all the research
that
you do?
Well, because I simply don't think there's such a thing as non-fiction. You know,
Yeah,
the so-called non-fiction book, the writer is making choices, what to put in and what to take out, what sentences, you know, the actual construction of the sentence. Why would you use this verb? Why would you know that? So it's all very, you know, it's, you can't write and be anything other than subjective. So perversely, I actually think fiction is much more honest than non-fiction.
Yeah, that's something that I've heard many times.
Right.
From my own standpoint, I agree with at least some of the time, depending on the fiction, of course.
Yeah, but I mean, if you take the Damned United, for example, but you know, I read all these books about you know Leeds United and Brian Clough. I mean, more books than I'd ever hoped to ever have to read about those things, and each book contradicted the other book. And you know, the Brian Clough, who is the, you know, the book is based on, he even wrote two autobiographies, and he managed in the autobiographies to contradict himself. So I mean, it's just this, you know. They're not, people don't intentionally lie, but it's just, you know, people get things wrong. And I just felt with fiction, you're not saying it's true. You're just saying this, you know, to me, it's like, this is what I imagined happened.
It's like nonfiction is the template for you to work off
yeah,
of.
Yeah, yeah.
And again, related to that, when I first discovered the Red Riding Quartet years ago, it was round about the same time that I also discovered Owen McNamee's work. And he, too, travels that sort of fiction fact continuum.
Yeah.
So,
and he's one of the finest writers we have.
Yeah, and I mean, I guess wanted to hear more about your take, especially his most recent book is
The Diet,
really 1220.
Risky. Yeah, 1223. Yeah, I and I think, you know, as I said, I'm a big, you know, one of the nicest things that's happened recently was to actually meet him and get to know him a little bit. I mean, personally, I think The Ultras is one of the best books of the last 10 years. But I mean, I don't have a particular, I don't, you know, I don't, unfortunately we didn't, I'm wishing maybe we should have talked about it. I mean, Gordon Byrne, you know, and Gordon and I did a reading in Ireland, which Owen arranged, and Owen did the kind of chair, but bizarrely, we didn't actually touch on this. So, yeah, it's, I don't have any, you know, it's just, I don't really have any, as you can gather, I don't really have any particular insight, I'm sorry.
No, that's fine. I think it's just more that, to me, there you two are somewhat linked just because of, you know, traveling similar, I guess, fiction territory.
Yeah.
And there aren't that, and because of both of you sort of could be perceived as crime fiction, especially Owen writing his pseudonymous thrillers.
Yeah.
So... yeah, I guess it's more just a question of, oh, I just wanted to bring this up.
No, but it's an interesting thing. But I mean, I don't, you know, and I think we've used, you know, in Resurrection Man, he based this on the Shankill Butchers, just as I took, and, you know, if you read the Shankill Butchers books, you can see where he's actually coming from. And the same, you know, one of the good things when I did the reading with Gordon Byrne in Ireland was, some of the passages in 1980 from The Victims what I call the transmission pieces, the unbroken kind of streams of consciousness pieces, they were actually based, there are sentences there that are taken from Gordon's work. And so I would read a passage and then he would read the passage that inspired me. And it was quite an interesting to go back to the non-fiction accounts to see how they had kind of then influenced the fictional parts. It was a good, that was what we tried to show.
Yeah. I think actually I did have a point, which is that what you two are doing is not all that common, at least in American crime fiction, and even to some extent in
British.
But
then, you know, a book like Libra by Don DeLillo, I mean, is a, you know, I mean, that I mean, to me, that was, to me, for example, one of the blueprints for GB84 was Libra by DeLillo. I mean, that was, you know, he's taking real, you know, Mailer did it as well. I mean, you know, taking true.
That's true with the Executioner song.
Yeah. Truman Capote, you know, it's just, there is a tradition of doing it. And I mean, you know, basically, I mean, not to get all Booker Prize about it, but the, how stories came about was from retelling true incidents. So, you know, Greek, you know, be it Greek plays or, the ancient Greek tragedies or Beowulf or Shakespeare, they're actually relating things that are supposedly happened and retelling them in an artistic manner. And of course, that then continues to me and Owen.
That's very true. Especially, I just heard from an author whose debut novel is essentially a retelling of the death of Ivan Ilyich.
Right.
And yet one of her inspirations was a young adult novel that was a novel for teens that was a retelling of Ivan Ilyich. So I see what you mean in that.
Yeah.
There are certain
types
that get retold.
One of the things I do is I spend at least an hour a day practicing what I call practicing, which means I take passages of books that I really admire and I write them out in longhand. And then I write them out and I work on the passage. You know, for example, if it's written to give examples. You know, if it's written in the third person, I change it to the first person. If it's written in the past, I change it to the present. I look at why an author's made the choices. And sometimes I'll write out like whole stories. And I actually think, you know, like a this goes back to say like, you know, Francis Bacon, his great works, his great portraits of Popes are based on Velazquez's, you know, he was trying to copy them. You know, a lot of kind of like, you know, we know that like a lot of great music are cover versions of other things. And I actually think that this idea of retelling other books, I think actually could, you know, I wish people would just start. And I don't know if they do it or not. I mean, but I can't, you know, other journalists and writers look at me agog that I do this kind of, you know, like I'll take like a H.P. Lovecraft story and I'll spend months reworking it. I don't do anything with it. You know, don't put it for sale or anything like that. But that's how I practice writing. And I think that this retelling was what we used to do. And I think one of the reasons why, to be honest, it's hardly anything worth reading is because people have kind of, we've somehow broken the link between the works of the past.
And that people don't seem to know what came before them.
Well, we don't know what came. They're obsessed with everything's got to be new. It's got to be, you've got to be new. And it's all, you've got to be kind of this like, obsession with like originality, and it's an originality, it's not the originality, it's what you're saying. And you know, you can retell things, you know, I'm not talking about, you know, turning like fucking Macbeth into a gangster film or something like that. I mean just, you know, to actually rework the art, because I mean basically there are some fundamental things that we seem to be kind of, anyway, I sound like a taxi driver. I'm in a rant.
Well, this is the perfect place to sound like a taxi driver.
Yeah, I was going to say.
I'm going to ask one more question just because I've kept you long enough and it's been an excellent conversation so far. But to sort of go back to A, knowing your history, and B...
I'm nervous kind of, now. What are you going to say? Go on.
It kind of goes back to what you were saying before about taking the what was originally the quartet and then shrinking it.
Yeah.
And what I'm curious about is why you didn't decide to say, look at what had happened prior to 1946, say in the 30s.
Yeah.
Because especially since this book does deal with the U.S. occupation,
yeah.
Why not look at rising anti-U.S. sentiments?
Yeah. And there are the flashbacks which continue. I mean, basically within the, I mean, even though I'm, you know, made all those big statements about how the occupied city is going to be different, it will still actually have to use what went before. You can't deny the link. And I am intrigued. You know, I always have like these. I mean, you know, I know what the next four books are going to be. You know, and I've had these kind of 11 books planned out for some time. And beyond that, I actually am quite drawn to writing about particularly what we call the Taisho period of Japanese history, which is...
Was that right before?
Yeah.
Okay.
Well, kind of, yeah. It's basically ended in 1927. But they encompass the Tokyo earthquake and things like that. And I think it was just this period really fascinates me. So there is a kind of... there are things I would still like to write about.
Oh, so that would also explain your recent essay in The Guardian.
Yeah, which they missed the last line out of.
Well, that was corrected, at least online.
Was it?
Yeah.
Oh, right,
yeah,
that's good. Yeah. Yeah.
But, yeah.
Yeah, no, that's... I mean, he has become... Akutagawa has become something of an obsession, yeah. And that... I've actually rewritten... I've got 9 of his stories rewritten. In a little book called Patient Number 23. I write books for myself, you see. So I've got this little book called Patient Number 23, which is my retellings of Akutagawa stories.
What first attracted you to his work?
Well, it was the story Inner Grove, which is the main story that Kurosawa used for the Rashomon film.
Sure.
And Inner Grove, to me, it's just this, you know, notion of the unreliable narrator and the contrasting kind of, again, going back to what we were talking about, fiction and fact. You know, he's got these 6 accounts of a rape and murder, and they're told by different people, plus one of them, you know, through a seance and things like this. And I just thought this was, I think he actually stole it from another, actually stole it from a French writer, but I've forgotten whom. It wasn't quite the unique thing that I thought it was, but I still thought it was, you know, fascinating. And then, you know, the more I've found out about him, and you know, so I'm really sad. I go on, you know. I mean, I suppose, you know, I spend time at his grave and stupid things like that.
So just to finally wrap it up, is there anything? I mean, you've talked about planning ahead in advance in many books. Is there any sort of time period or type of book that you're really hoping to get to at some point that hasn't been covered yet?
Well, I mean, at the moment, really, I can't. I have these boxes in the office, and they're big white cardboard boxes, and inside these boxes are the like remaining 4 books that are contracted. So there's Occupied City, the 3rd book, then there's UKDK, and then there's the Yorkshire Rippers, is a plural, and there are these boxes, and then there are other boxes of what could become smaller boxes of what could become, like, you know, I was talking about the Taisho period and things like that. But really, I mean, to be honest, I've had such a bad year with Occupied City, and I still have got to obviously finish it for March next year. I'm really trying not to think beyond the Occupied City.
And on that note, we will call this an interview. Thanks so much for taking the time to talk
with
me.
Well, thank you very much. Thank you. Cigarette case. Bring a mirror to my face. Let all my